Human beings, we are social creatures, and we're groupish. You know, we are drawn to be a part of a group. Get to find our place in a social setting. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's even God designed. God designed us to have not only an individual identity, but even a corporate identity. And there's good in belongingness. However, in our broken world, so many of our issues are due to the challenges that occur in group interaction, group dynamics, group rivalry, and conflict. And starting this morning and the next few weeks, we're going to talk about some of those dynamics that happen when groups overlap. So let me catch you up on where we're at on Sunday mornings here. We're going through a series called Resilience, and the goal is to build resiliency into our church family here. And the idea is that we live in a pretty unstable, unsettling world, and we need resiliency. We need stability in some ways. We need strength and endurance. And so we're going after that this year. And how we're doing that is we're teaching through the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' famous, you know, is the longest recorded sermon in the Bible in Matthew 5 through 7. And we're just slowly walking through that over the course of the year. However, we're also interspersing in there little mini-series. And so we're teaching a few weeks on the Sermon on the Mount, and then we take a few weeks and go through some mini-series related to a cultural issue, something that our world may be struggling with, something that we think we need to tackle in order to create resiliency in our church family. And so we are embarking on one of those mini-series right now, and we're going to be talking about ideas related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And some of you are like, do you enjoy pain? And the answer is no, we don't enjoy pain. We actually think it might be more painful to avoid these kinds of issues. And then we need to talk about them. We need to understand what the Bible says about ideas that are floating out there and really that are everywhere. And so we're going to talk about that. However, this week we're not quite going to jump into that ideology yet. We're going to prepare a little bit. And we're going to give some background and foundation. And really this morning is intended to prepare us not only for the next few weeks tackling diversity and equity and inclusion, but also future mini-series. In a couple months, we're going to embark on one that involves more religious pluralism and even Christian nationalism. We're going to talk about those things. So this week is more just a primer and getting ready for the next 3 weeks of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So what I'm going to do this morning is I am going to talk a little bit about two of those words, diversity and inclusion. You know, diversity and inclusion are very biblical values, strong values in the Bible. And so we should promote those values, diversity and inclusion. And yet at the same time, those values need to be balanced and held in tension with other very biblical values. And so what I'd like to do is to draw out some of those balances, some of those tensions related to both diversity and inclusion. And so let's do that. And before we really get into it, I just want to remind our kids that we have a kids question, as we do every week of the summer. And so near the end of my sermon, I'll be asking you the question. So all I want you to do is actually just simply note the two tensions that we talk about today. And I'm going to have you tell me what they are. Right? Okay, so tension number one, diversity and unity. Okay, unity and diversity. Okay, there is this tension in the Bible. Yes, diversity is a very strong value in the Bible, and yet unity is as well. And we have to figure out how those two dance together. Okay. Now, Let's talk about unity first. Now, unity, of course, is a strong emphasis in the Bible, and that almost goes without saying. If you've read the Bible at all, you see unity jumping off of its pages. It was what Jesus prayed for in his final prayer in John 17. He prayed for us, and he prayed that we may be united. We see throughout all the epistles, we see this admonition to seek unity, that we as believers especially should be united. So united is a very high value with God. But not only is unity valued among say us as believers, I also would say that we see a promotion of unity even between people groups. Especially in the New Testament, we see that between Jew and Gentile. So let me read Ephesians 2, 14 through 16. It says, "For he himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility." This is what God did through Jesus. He removed this dividing wall, and he made the two one and brought them together in one body. Similarly, we could go to Galatians 3:28 a little more succinctly. It says, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. There is neither Jew nor Greek." So again, these two peoples, there's this dividing wall that's been eliminated, and at least in the context that he's talking about right here, there is a oneness. There's no Jew, there is no Greek. So unity is everywhere, and God desires for peoples to be brought together. However, there's also this diversity value, and I want to dive into that a little bit more thoroughly because sometimes I think we miss it in the Bible. Diversity is very valuable to God, and we see that from the very beginning. I want to go back to Genesis 1 in Creation Week and ask, what does God do in Creation Week? Well, of course, God creates. He created the heavens and the earth. He breathed them into existence. But it describes the earth as without form and void. Whatever that means, God created matter in some way, but it was formless. It didn't have a lot of cohesion. But then God started doing stuff. And here's what he does, Creation Week. Number one, he separates the light from the darkness or the day from the night. Then he separates the waters from the waters. Whatever that means, there are different theories, but he separates the waters from the waters. Then he separates the dry land from the waters. Then he creates the vegetation according to their kinds. Then he creates sources of light, specifically the two great lights to govern the day and the night, and then other lights, and through the lights, he distinguishes between seasons and days and years, is what it says. Then he creates the sea creatures and birds according to their kinds. He creates the land animals according to their kinds, and he finally creates humans and then separates them into male and female. So this is what God does throughout Creation Week. He took this initial mass of stuff, and then he begins to inject contrast and distinction into it. And day after day, he separates, and then he separates, and then he organizes according to kinds. And he's creating distinction and contrast and wonderful variety and diversity. And this is what God does right away. He injects that diversity into his creation. Of course, he also does this with the church. We could fast forward. 1 Corinthians 12 describes the church as a body and uses this metaphor of the body, that we are certainly united in one body under one head, and yet every church member is a different part of the body. And some are eyes, and some are ears, and some are feet, and some are hands, and we play these different roles. And it says that God arranged the members in the body, each one of them, as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? If everybody was the same, what would that even look like? No, he made distinction, and he limited, and he gave certain roles, and then he arranged them all together, and he arranged this wonderful diversity within the church. And so God injects diversity into the created order, into nature, and he injects diversity into the church. But what I want to highlight this morning is something that we may not always notice or that is a little more subtle. I believe that God also desired diversity of culture. He wanted diversity of culture. I think we see the beginnings of culture, again, near the beginning in Genesis 4. Let me read this little passage in Genesis 4. It says, "And Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah." And what we see here, we see different lineages developing certain affinities. There's these groups of people. And one group of people, they began to excel at farming and keeping animals. And one group of people, they began to excel musically. They were known as the musicians, and it's implied that another group of people may have become the craftsmen, and they really excelled working with metal. And we see the beginnings of culture, groups of people that become a little more distinct, and they have certain strengths and weaknesses and affinities that they may excel at. And I think this is what God desired. I think this is how he designed it. I think when God says to fill the earth, he didn't just mean fill the earth with bodies. I think he might have meant fill the earth with cultures as well. This is just how it was going to unroll. We have limited relational capacity, and so we become a part of a group, and then those groups take on a certain character. And they grow, and they express themselves in diverse ways. And I believe that that was God's intention. And then as we go on in the Bible, we see God making reference to peoples quite a bit. A little later in Genesis 12, of course, there's the blessing and the promise that's given to Abram at this point. And God blesses him, and he says, "I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." And it's interesting that he didn't just say all the people of the earth will be blessed. He makes this distinction, and he says all the families, all the peoples, these specific circles of people will be blessed through you and your descendants. Like your descendants were going to flavor those peoples. And we see that again in the Great Commission. Later on in Matthew 28, and Jesus said to make disciples of all nations. And that's interesting again, that he didn't just say make disciples, just of people in general, but he said make disciples of all nations, meaning again that each circle of people was going to be influenced by God's people. God's people were going to grow up into each of these pockets. And God, I believe, wanted to preserve that diversity. He didn't want to just blur it all together, but he was preserving it and then influencing it with his people. And then, of course, we could go to the very end, and this was really the exclamation point on this idea. At the very end, in Revelation 21, we see God creating the new heavens and the earth. And it says this at one point. It says, "By God's light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into the city, the holy city. And its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations." And somehow the glory of the nations and the nations themselves were to be preserved. And they were all going to come. They will all come into this new earth, this holy city. And there will be distinct features, I think, of each of those nations that will still remain. I think even in heaven. And we'll see Saudi Arabian hospitality. And we'll see Japanese reverence for elders. And we'll have Indian naan bread. Oh Lord, let India bring their glory into the city. And I think he's going to preserve these cultural distinctions because he loves diversity. So we have this initial tension of unity and diversity. And God obviously very much values unity, and he's bringing everybody together, and in certain ways he's eliminating distinctions. And yet at the same time, he's preserving distinctions. He's preserving groups of people. And yet he wants them to be united. And this is the dance, and this is the dance that's always hard to dance for us as human beings, to maintain each of these. Well, as we move forward into our discussions in the upcoming weeks about diversity, equity, and inclusion, we're going to try to keep this tension in mind, okay, and see how it affects us and how it affects different challenges that we have in this world. Okay, second tension is going to have to deal with inclusion. Okay, inclusivity is a high value in the world, and it's also a high value in the Bible. But I want to draw out a tension here also, and I've drawn out this tension before. Actually, a few years ago, I set up this tension and this kind of spectrum in a message once. It's always nice just to recycle a message, you know, it saves some work. But actually, it's not just recycling, it's going to be a little different, but the same kind of setup here, just for our purposes over the next few weeks. But this tension or this spectrum, I think, reflects even our current political inclinations. Okay, this is expressed in our politics. It's expressed in a lot of other things as well, as we'll get to. But this is expressed in our politics. So I might ask you, to start off, I'm going to ask you this. What's the difference between a Republican and a Democrat? It's not a joke, actually. I'm actually serious. Like, what is the difference between a Republican and a Democrat? What might pull somebody in one direction or the other, to the left or to the right? And I've asked that question to a lot of people, and there's a variety of different answers. It's about size of government, or it's really just how comfortable you are with change, or how much you desire for things to stay the same, how much you like how things are going, and how much you don't like how things are going. And those are pieces of it, but I think there's something actually more fundamental that's expressed in all kinds of different situations. And this really struck me. I was reading a book a few years ago by a man named Michael Barone, and the book is called How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. Here's what he says. Parties as long-lasting as these are two major political parties in the United States. I submit, even as they shift positions in response to events and elections, represent something basic in the character of the nations they have governed with considerable and recurring success. So there's something basic is his proposal. And then he describes that, at least in the U.S. And he says, the Democratic Party, from its beginnings of the 1830s, has always been a collection of outgroups, of demographic groups that have not been regarded by themselves or others as typically American, but which, taken together, and it is almost always a problem holding them together, make up a majority of the nation. And the Republican Party has always been formed around a core group considered to be typical Americans, but which by itself has never been a majority of the electorate and must attract others to the party's banner in order to win. Okay. And so this is what he would observe after studying the last almost 200 years of dynamics between political parties. And so the idea is that there's this culture and there's kind of a core, there's a center that could be described as American perhaps, or just the center of this culture or community. And then there is a collection of groups that feel a little bit more on the outside. And so, on the left, the Progressive Party has typically represented those groups on the outside, and their concern, for the most part, is bringing the outside in. I lost my color. That was supposed to be blue somehow. Anyways, that's the concern, is bringing the outside in. The other party represents the people in that core, but not just the individual people, the ideas that shape them, the character. That was supposed to be red. the principles, the values, the affections of what seems to define the culture. Okay, and so that has been typically how our parties have been arranged. Now, I think that reflects something that is pretty consistent in almost all group interaction. And so we could lay this out as a tension or as a spectrum, and this is how I labeled it a few years ago. On the left, the impulse is towards inclusion, and on the right, the impulse is towards what I'm calling core building. Okay? And to tease out what this means or what this looks like a little bit, let's think about some of the values that might be associated with each side. On the left, there's accessibility, empathy, mercy, accommodation. Okay, we want to make things accessible, and we're going to accommodate so that people can be brought in. That's the idea. It's the impulse. And on the right, there's principle or values, standards, excellence, purity, honor, these sorts of things among many others. And this might describe the leanings in the spectrum. Or you could describe it in another way. Maybe it's the classic tension between the one and the many. And on one side, there's concern about the one, the individual, maybe the one that's on the outside. And then on the other side, there's the concern for the many, the whole, the society as a whole. Let's strengthen it and make it healthy. Or when it comes to standards that are kept, how does each side view standards? Well, on the left, the tendency might be to relax standards for the sake of attainability. And on the right, to maintain standards and call people to meet them. And we've probably benefited, each one of us has benefited from each approach. And so perhaps there's been something in your life that you've really struggled with. It's challenging to you. You don't feel like you can quite muster up what you need, but then somebody in some way relaxes or accommodates, they extend a deadline for you. Or they allow you to step in when it was a real challenge for you. Or on the other side, perhaps a teacher or a coach, maybe a coach really challenged you and challenged you to meet a standard that you wouldn't have approached on your own, but called you to something outside of yourself and greater than yourself. We've probably benefited from each approach here. But this is describing these different tendencies, and as I said, they're not just expressed in our political parties, but I think they are expressed at every level of community. Let's think about how they're expressed in different ways. They're expressed in the family, in the church, in the community, in the nation. The family, there's this dance again, holding this tension. A family, of course, must build a family culture. Maybe especially a family has to define themselves. A family, you know, there's an affection, there's an exclusive affection for each other. Okay, I have an exclusive love for my wife and my kids that I don't have for the rest of you. And that's appropriate. And there's a disproportionate amount of time that I spend with my wife and kids, and again, that's appropriate. Okay, there's this culture that I'm building, there's this circle, and we're injecting things into it, and there are standards that we keep, and so there's right and there's wrong. Things we do and things we don't do. There are other values that we have. Maybe a family has the value of loyalty or joy or service. We're going to be a family that serves. Or perhaps there are just pursuits that a family pursues. We're a musical family. We're a soccer family. We're a family that raises animals or whatever it might be. Sometimes there are just traditions or patterns that you develop. We eat pancakes on Saturday mornings every week. And it's part of our family culture. There's patterns that we develop, and it defines us. And not every family has to eat pancakes on Saturday mornings, but every family probably needs something like that. They need some kind of pattern, something that defines them. They define their culture through their values, their standards, their patterns. At the same time, I want the doors of my home to be open. Okay, and I want to welcome people, and I want to host people, and I want to see them drawn in, and I want to expose my family culture to outsiders and have them be blessed by my family culture. Okay, and so there's this dance where we are trying to form a somewhat tight culture, and yet at the same time we're trying to draw people in and expose them to that culture as well. In the church, it really plays out in the church. Again, the dance. You know, every Sunday school class, youth group meeting, small group meeting, there's this tension where you're trying to decide is, you know, what kind of sensitivity to give to the visitor, to the one who's struggling with something, to the one who lacks understanding, maybe doesn't have faith yet, or is just new to their faith, and you're balancing the sensitivity to that person with a desire to provide depth and maturity and challenge people and dig into truth. And you're trying to balance that. You know, every time we come here on Sunday morning, we're playing with this tension. I mean, you did it when you decided what to wear this morning. What do you wear when you come to church? And some of you are like, Pastor, your shirt's not tucked in. Why are you so slovenly? This is a special time, and it is. And when God's people gather together to worship him, it is a special, set-apart time. And we should project how special that is, even through our dress. And we should make sure that this time is considered to be precious and valuable and even delicate. And so we should express a reverence here. Others of you are like, Ritter, why are you wearing a collared shirt? Why are you so stuffy? We should create an atmosphere here where people don't have to put on airs when they come in. They don't feel uncomfortable. They can come just as they are. God is accessible. His arms are open. And so we should create an environment that doesn't feel overly formal. Both have a point, in my opinion, and the difficulty is figuring out where do we land and what's appropriate and taking into account our culture and how things work and the people that we know and the people that we're trying to connect with and all of this, and there's the dance there. There's community at the community level. You know, we form this community culture. You know, in Fort Collins, we love our bikes and our beer. We're known for that. And we're proud of it, and so we promote it, and it's, those things have a special place in our hearts, and we form this kind of culture, and so every community they develop this identity, and they support each other, they support their local sports teams, and get behind those teams, and they cheer for them because they represent us, and we should be connected there, and we should support each other like that, form that kind of culture. That's why if you're here and you're a Raiders fan or a Chiefs fan, you're probably in sin. That's how I read my Bible. No, actually, there have actually been two sets of Chiefs fans that have infiltrated my small group recently. They're sitting back there. When I wasn't looking, they came in, and Chad Schneider's like, bro, what are we doing? Do we have any standards here at all? I say, Chad, we've got to include. We've got to draw in even those kinds of people and trust that they'll be reformed. But you see this dance. You see this dance in the community. And at the national level, of course, this is where all of our political debates come out. And we saw it really intensely a couple years ago in the middle of COVID. One side was concerned about the vulnerable. What about those people that could be harmed by this virus? Let's take extra precautions for them, the outsider. The other side was like, if we strip away all of these key features of society, relational interaction, education, commerce, then the whole society is going to crumble. And then everybody's going to be hurt, not just the vulnerable. And that was the tension. And we went back and forth. And of course, it was very, very intense. But we see how this plays out all the time. And of course, it plays out in the Bible as well. And we see God express each of these impulses. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 19. I'll read the first few verses of the chapter. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and his father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves any gods of cast metal. I am the Lord your God.'" And you see God establishing this culture and giving it a holy center. But then a few verses later, he says this: "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. Neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God." And so there are special accommodations made for the outsider. Of course, we see this in the life of Jesus as well. Jesus formed a tight culture, and he even chose a select number of people, 12 specifically, and he invested heavily into those 12. And he kept and even raised standards. That's what we've been learning about during the Sermon on the Mount. He had high standards. He called people out of sin and into holiness. And yet at the same time, Jesus is known for the company he kept, and he kept company with the tax collector and the prostitute and the foreigner. And so we see this expressed in the life of Jesus. And so we might ask, well, okay, well, what's the deal? Is, you know, are both sides good, and does it really matter? And the answer is yes and no. Yes, there is a godly impulse in each direction, expressed even in the life of Christ. But the danger is at the extremes. And when you drift to one side or the other and then untether yourself from the balancing values of the other side. Let me give you another word picture. Say you have this house. You've built a house. The left is concerned about the doors. And the doors and the windows. Can we get into the house? Can people get into the house? Can we see in? Can we see out? Can we get out? And the right is concerned about what's going on inside the house and maybe the foundation of the house, the arrangement of the rooms, what's being made to eat in there, the life that is happening inside the house. Now, if you push to the right, then things begin to close a little bit. You've got to turn and squeeze into the door. It's a little hard to get in, and it starts to feel a little stifling. And then, of course, you keep going, and then you can't get in or out. And then it becomes very suffocating as you push and push and push to the right side. The left, you start with your house, and then the doors are widened. And you widen the doors to let more and more people in, but then you continue widening, and then there's nothing left. There's no cohesion, there's no substance there, and the outside is no different from the inside. There's nothing of value and substance, and so we want to belong, but then there's nothing to belong to. And so you see the danger at each extreme. And so we could set up our spectrum like this, where there's of course a good godly impulse in each direction, but then it gets dangerous as you go out to the ends. And so let's again play with this and see how it works. Let's say you have a community here that's trying to build a culture, build a core, establish values, establish identity, and this is a good thing. And it is a good thing, and it will continue to be a good thing as long as they remain tethered to empathy, to have this empathetic spirit. Okay, we're going to establish this culture, but we're going to hold on to empathy, and that is a good thing. But as this community pulls and pulls to the right, then this rope starts to fray a little bit. And then it starts to get unhealthy, where the empathetic spirit is beginning to drift away and become less clear. And we could think about how this happens in our different kinds of communities. I'll just point out a couple examples. You know, with a family, It becomes, maybe the family culture becomes stifling and rigid, overly constrained. Maybe resentment in the home starts to develop. In the church, we have to be very aware of this. It starts to be unwelcoming. And people show up to our church gathering, and maybe they enjoy the experience, and they like it and see some good things, and they stick around for a couple weeks, but as they stick around, they can never seem to get in. It's like they always feel on the outside. They always feel a little bit of at a distance. It's like, these people have something going, but I don't think I can access it. And it starts to feel like that in a church. And of course, as a church, we have to be very, very aware of that. But that can happen at each of these levels of community. And then eventually the rope breaks. And then you drift into this very dangerous place, and the family becomes abusive. And a church becomes a cult. And a nation becomes oppressive and eliminates people groups that don't belong in that nation. And it ends in elitism, authoritarianism, and even death. And of course, we see this in the Bible, and this is what Jesus experienced. This is what Paul experienced. Let me read about Paul's experience. When he came to Jerusalem, and he was giving his testimony before the crowds at Jerusalem, and he was relaying how Jesus spoke to him in a vision, he says this, "And he, Jesus, said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.' Up to this word, they listened to him. Then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live.'" And they were in this place, this dangerous place, where if Paul is claiming that God sent him to other peoples, that's out of line, and that can't happen. And so they wanted to kill him. Now we can look at the other side and say there's this community over here, and they want to grow in inclusivity and welcome people in, and it's a good thing, and that could be a good and healthy thing as long as they remain tethered to objective values. That's what I'm saying. They hold on to objective values. If they continue their efforts to love and to include, it has to be held on to as you push towards inclusivity. But of course, that rope can fray as well. And then it becomes unhealthy. And you look at these different communities, and in the family, there's not that center, and the members of the family begin to sort of dissolve. You know, I can be very, very cognizant of this even as a pastor, because pastors' families and pastors' kids have a reputation. And the reputation is that pastors' kids often become rebellious, and you ask, why is that? And oftentimes, it's probably because the children always felt like dad's focus was outside. Like he never created this home, this center for us. He was always concerned about other things. There was nothing special about us. And then there is that rebelliousness that eventually happens. When a church perhaps emphasizes the seeker too much, or becomes really concerned about accommodating for people, it can just feel like the substance and the depth and the cohesiveness start to dissolve away. And you've probably experienced that, and I've experienced that. I've led groups like that, where there's this overemphasis on inclusion, and then you lose the substance of what you're doing. You know, in the community, schools can begin to crumble. I've talked to a number of standards are lowered and lowered and lowered, and the children begin to suffer, and then there's not much left, and families begin to leave, and it just, again, doesn't have the center there. So that can happen at each one of these levels. And then, eventually, again, the rope breaks, and we end up in the same place: elitism, authoritarianism, and death. Now, this is perhaps unexpected or counterintuitive, because you wouldn't think that an impulse that leads you towards empathy, mercy, would end in authoritarianism. But I actually think it does. And I think we see evidence of it in lots of places. You know, maybe in the home, the father's attention was turned outside and the family started to pull apart some. And then the dad noticed that everything was pulling apart and there wasn't any definition. And so then he clamps down. Says, this isn't working. This is too disordered. We've got to bring order. And that certainly can happen. And you go to the national level, and again, you can see that. And last century, we saw this consistently, where strongly left-leaning governments eventually resulted in oppression, brutal oppression. And so we can see that begin to come a part of the seams, and then there is a clamping down. Now, I think we see the seed of this in the story of the first murder in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 4. I want to read about Cain's murder of his brother Abel. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it." Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up and against his brother Abel and killed him. And what we see here, I think it's kind of subtle, but I think what we see is that God had standards, and he had asked both Cain and Abel to do something and to do something specific. But Cain said, "I don't want to do that, and I'm going to make my own way." And it's really a desire for inclusivity. He wanted anything that he did to be accepted. And so he did his own thing, and then when it was not accepted, he became very, very angry. And of course, that anger led to murder. So we see this happening, and we see the spectrum, and we see how the extremes are play out, and the danger on both sides of the extreme. So with that all in mind, let me set up how we're going to approach the next few weeks, or why we're talking about what we're talking about. Say, there's a person standing here on the right side of the spectrum, okay, but in a healthy spot, and this is how they see the world. Standing here, oftentimes, this person looks to the left, and they see a cliff. They see a cliff over here off of which society is about to tumble, and society is going to fall off this cliff and be destroyed on the rocks below. Okay, so they see this cliff, and that cliff in their mind is labeled diversity, equity, and inclusion. That the world has adopted an ideology that is so radically inclusive that it's over there on that extreme side, and and society is about to tumble off this cliff. That's the thought. Now, somebody could be standing on this side of the spectrum, and they can look to the right side of the spectrum, and they also see a cliff, and society is about to tumble off of this cliff. How would they label that cliff? They might label it Christian nationalism. Whether that's fair or not, and I mean, who knows what Christian nationalism even is? And you ask 100 different people, and you get 100 different answers. And so, recognizing that is the understanding, at least in a lot of the world, we're going to try to address each of those sides. And we're going to try to understand, okay, is that the reality? Okay, in this DEI ideology, is it really over there on the red side? Is there good? Is there bad? Is there some meat to eat and we should spit out the bones? Or what's going on here? We're going to try to evaluate that. And then again, later, end of August, we're going to take a look at not only Christian nationalism, but some other ideas related to that, and also ask, is it over there? Or what is it? And how should we think about it? And how does the world think about that? And I mean, the label Christian is there. Is that right or not? We're going to take a look at that. That's the idea. That's why we're doing this. We think these ideas are just permeating our world, and therefore we need to address them and understand them. So what we're going to be doing in the next 3 weeks, we're going to be talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And next week, I'm just going to try to explain it. I just want to try to draw out some of the contours of thought here, some of the history. What are the main emphases in this way of thinking? And so it's just going to be explanation. And secondly, there's going to be assessment. The week after, it's like, okay, let's take those ideas and take them through a biblical lens and see what the Bible has to say for good or for bad about them. And the third week will be, where do we go? After evaluating things, okay, where do we go from here? How do we apply what is an appropriate expression as a Christian of diversity, equity, and inclusion? With that, I would welcome you to invite your friends. I know that can be dangerous. But I think this is permeating our world so much that I think it could be a great opportunity to begin a conversation. There are a lot of ideas about a lot of thoughts about DEI, and there are a lot of thoughts about what Christians believe about those ideas. Maybe this would be a great opportunity to start a conversation. Okay, so with that, we're going to do our kids question before I finish up with just a few closing thoughts. And so, I think we've got Colin there with a mic, and I'm going to ask the question, and then I'm going to point to some hand that I see go up. So this, again, is for kids 7 through 12 that are in the service with us this summer. And if you haven't gotten a prize before, you can answer. Okay, if you have gotten a prize, you can answer. But I'll see somebody who raises their hand first, and then we'll let Colin give you the mic and have you answer the question. And if you get this question right, we actually have Bojos. Okay, so this is a good week. Yeah. All right, so here we go. Kids question. What are the two tensions we covered today? I just want the words there. I give you the first letter of each of the words. Okay, I think I saw somebody way back there. I think that's Riley.
Okay, Riley, give me your name and your age and what you think the answer is.
My name is Riley and my age is 10, and I think the answer is unity, diversity, inclusion, and core building.
There you go. Nice job. Yeah. All right. Come, here's some Bojos for you. Not for your dad, just you, okay? Okay, let me wrap up with a few final thoughts. And these are important final thoughts, actually. We're going to go a little late this morning. But you know, last time I spoke, we finished the service 3 minutes early. I noted that. And so I feel like I earned something for today. 3 minutes earns you like 15 minutes late, I think. Okay, I want to just review, again, our two tensions really quickly. We've got unity and diversity. And these, you know, since the dawn of time, we've been wrestling with this. And human beings can't seem to figure out how to value both unity and diversity. But we as Bible-believing Christians have a grounding for the value of both. Okay, we can uphold both of those because we see these things in God. And I don't think you see this resolved tension anywhere else except in the God described by the Bible. Let's go back to Genesis 1 again, and I'm going to read the first verse of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Pretty simple, except in English, we miss something here. So let me read from Jonathan Sarfdi's Genesis commentary. He says, in Genesis 1:1, we have the first mention of God, Elohim, and it is full of meaning. First, this is the name that fits the Almighty Creator of the universe. Second, the plural form, Elohim, combined with the singular verb, bara, establishes the vital uniplural nature of God, which has its full revelation in the New Testament in its clear teaching of the Trinity. First verse in the Bible hints at something, and that is that God is both diverse and united. And this mysterious reality is that the essence of reality, God himself, is three, he's diverse, and yet he's one. And God brings together in himself unity and diversity. And we can look at that God, and we can hold them in proper tension as we stare at him. And I really believe that. We have something to bring to the world because we have a foundation for both unity and diversity. Our second tension was inclusion and core building. These also we have struggled with. Ever since the garden, we've struggled to hold both of these in a proper tension. Nobody could do it until Jesus did it. And when Jesus came, he did it. I just want to read a short part of a verse, 1 Peter 3:18. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. Three quick points, conclusions from this verse. Number one, Jesus Christ lived a fully righteous life. Jesus came to this earth, and then he upheld all the standards. He kept God's values. Okay, he lived a perfectly righteous life. But number two, he suffered and died for the sins of the unrighteous, and that's us. We're unrighteous. We sin. But why did he need to suffer and die for the unrighteous? Well, it's because due to our unrighteousness, we were excluded from the core. Okay, we were on the outside. God is holy, and so he only lets holy things into his core. We were on the outside because we were unholy, we were unrighteous, and we deserved a death penalty for our unrighteousness. Death penalty to be eternally separated from God, we deserved that. But Jesus came and he died in our place. We deserved to be killed. He stepped into that punishment and took it for us. And so it was taken off of our shoulders, and when that was removed from us, there was no longer something keeping us outside of God. And so number three, this death brought us to God. When we receive that by believing that Jesus did that for us, we're brought into the center with God. And we see in this, we call this the gospel, that Jesus resolved this. He kept all the standards. He maintained holiness. He punished unrighteousness, but he took it himself in love, and then he brought us into himself. And he just offers that. He offers that to all of us. He offers to be brought, for all of us to be brought in simply by trusting him, believing that he did that for us, and putting our faith there. And just with a simple prayer, we receive that and are brought in. And I want to encourage all of you, if you have not yet received that, to do so. Jesus is the one that resolves this tension, and he wants to resolve it for you. But when we receive that, God fills us. God actually comes into us. And then again, we have the resources. We have God himself living in us. And we can then bring that resolved tension to the world. And we can fill each of those nations with that resolved tension. And see them brought to God himself. And see how that affects society as well. To see this perfect balancing of inclusion and core building. So we can do that. And so as we approach the next 3 weeks, I think we can do it confidently, believing that God has done it, and so he can express that through us, and we can affect our world. With that, we're going to celebrate what he did for us through the breaking of bread. And Jesus asked us to remember what he did, remember that death that earned us unity with God, to be brought into his family, to remember that death, that he broke down that barrier, and to regularly, just through tasting the bread and drinking from the cup, It was to remind us of what he did. I'm going to read how Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians 11. For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way also he took the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat the bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." And Steve and Zeke, you can come on up here as well. But we're going to celebrate this right now. We're going to take the bread and the cup. And there should be the elements right in front of you, but if you need a gluten-free option, you can certainly raise your hand, and our ushers should be able to give one to you. And we're going to take this together. We're getting that, hopefully. So we're celebrating, we're remembering that God did this for us, that Jesus died so that we could be with him. And again, as we eat and we drink, we are able to remember and experience what he did for us. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to reflect for a moment on that. We are actually just going to remember. That's the whole idea, is to remember what God did. Again, raise your hand. I think we've got the elements coming around for gluten-free options. We're just going to remember. So I want to give you just a moment in silence to reflect on what Jesus did in the breaking of his body and the pouring out of his blood. And remember it. And then in a few moments, I'm going to ask us to take it all together, and we'll eat and drink together in remembrance, and then we're going to close with one final song. So take that moment right now and reflect on what Jesus did. Thank you, Jesus, that you came to this earth and lived a righteous life and then poured out your blood and broke your body so that we could be whole and we could return to you.